Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Navigating Workplace Bullying, Finding Resilience and Experiencing Joy, Even in Crisis. And my name is Christina Jensen. I've known Andy Riegel for just over 6 months now, and it is my pleasure to introduce to you the host of the series. And Andy, welcome to your own show.
Yes, thanks, Christina. It's nice to be on the other side. I'll let you ask the questions and we'll have the conversation, but this is really great. Thank you.
Oh, sounds great. And all of you, you are in for a treat. And it is my pleasure to read Andy's bio to you. I think you're going to be quite surprised and just pleased. Andy Riegel is an Emmy nominated and award winning media executive, speaker, and author. He has been an executive producer, executive vice president of programming, and VP of original programming at renowned organizations such as Court TV, CSNBC, and MSNBC. As the global head of video of Wall Street Journal, Andy led a dynamic team of journalists across global hubs in New York, Washington, San Francisco, London, and Hong Kong. That's like the whole world, Andy.
It was a worldwide news operation, indeed.
That's amazing. And despite his success, Andy's career was not without its challenges. So for decades, he experienced workplace bullying and incivility, an ordeal that profoundly shaped his present advocacy and commitment to fostering healthier work environments. Andy is dedicated to teaching individuals who have experienced workplace bullying how to reclaim their joy and sense of meaning and purpose in their lives. Andy, it is so wonderful to be here with you today and to have you tell your story and hear how you are dedicated to helping individuals basically take back their lives.
Yeah. When I was looking back, Christina, on my career, I had a little bit more time during COVID, and I decided to write down, chronicle much of my adult life, mostly for my kids, so that they would know me as a full-fledged person as opposed to just dad.
Mm.
So in my generation, I think it was pretty common not to really know your parents as full people, but just as the people that took care of you. That was my experience anyway. I mean, yes, I knew my parents, but not in a personal way, not in a way that I would understand that they experienced frustrations and disappointments and failures in their life. And I wanted my kids to know that, yes, I had experienced all those things. So I started writing it down in a manuscript. And what I found was a through line or theme of workplace incivility. And I didn't know the term at the time, but looking back on it, I was just struck by, not that I wasn't aware of it, but it was so common in my career in television that I really wanted to look into it more. But I didn't even know the word workplace bullying. And I didn't know that anybody else had experienced it. I thought that I had asked for it pretty much. I chose a career in television. I moved from Chicago to New York. Much of my career was in live television, which is high pressure and a lot of anxiety, a lot of tension. And I kind of asked for it. This is what I asked for. This is what I wanted. This is what I pursued. This is what I loved. And as I looked into it more, I found out there were actually lots of people who are expert in this area, that there's a whole body of research and experts, psychiatrists, psychologists, advocates, scientists looking at this issue. And for once, I wasn't alone. I didn't really feel as though it was just me and it was my fault and that it was just television. I found that this happens. It's rampant in healthcare. It's rampant in all disciplines, in education, in nonprofit, you name it, in religious organizations, everywhere. Somebody recently said to me, where you'll find people in the workplace, you'll find bullying and incivility. So, having done that and talked to experts and researched it and written my book, I now feel that I want to help other people who are experiencing this or have experienced this and felt as I did, that they were alone and full of shame.
Amazing. And I'm curious to know, Andy, you know, what are the feelings that you have experienced over the course of decades of being bullied? And what are the feelings that you now know are universal in being bullied?
Yeah. Well, first, I'd like to say, kind of in my defense, but also in the defense of bully targets or bully victims everywhere, is, you know, I had so much shame because I didn't know how to fight off the bullies. And they did, in almost every case, have more power than me. They controlled my paycheck and they controlled my ability to move up in my career. And the thing that I found was most of us who are bullied in the workplace aren't kind of that stereotypical victim on the playground, the wimp, if you will, which there's no excuse for bullying anyone. In fact, one of the things I found as I began to write my book was there in many school districts around the country, there's zero tolerance of bullying. But in my view, there's 100% tolerance of bullying in workplaces around the country. So we're not the shy, retiring, quiet, introverted types. What I found was, and I learned that many bully victims, most in fact, are people that are loyal, devoted, dedicated, and productive. And for some reason, and we can get into this a little bit, that sometimes brings out the bullying in supervisors, managers, and sometimes even colleagues. And it's hard to understand why that is, but it is usually the case. And so I looked back at my career to answer your question directly. I looked back at my career as I was writing my book, and I felt like I was a failure. I just thought I was a failure because this seemed to happen to me over and over and over again. And there must have been something about me that brought this on, that the bullies could smell me. And what was true, and I don't blame this on myself any longer. I don't have self-blame about this, but it happens to be true. They knew, the bullies, the mean-spirited people that I worked for and with, they knew that I wasn't going to yell and scream and fight back and go to HR. Not that that would have helped any, but they knew that I was the kind of person that was going to take whatever was given to me and then go back to my desk and try harder. And that is a failing strategy, which is why I called my book, I Thought It Would Be Different. Because at every job, I thought, well, that job, that person, you know, the next job, I won't have this happen again because I'm going to be even better. And I was already working as hard as anybody. I was the first one in, last one out. And that's true of many bully victims. So I'd like to think that just because my career was in television, and I have white privilege, I acknowledge that as often as I can. I was well paid in many of the jobs I had. I got promoted. But why I'm so interested in this issue and spending a lot of time on it in advocacy and helping others is because this is that rare issue where it can happen to anyone. In fact, it happens more to people of color. It happens more to people in the LGBTQI community. It happens more to women, but it happens to everyone. It happens to men like myself with white privilege. It happens to all socioeconomic categories. You could be a senior person. You could be an intern. In fact, one of the most interesting things I came across recently, Christina, and I think you'll find this interesting, is that medical interns, full-fledged doctors, but who are starting out in their careers, are some of the worst bully targets because the older, more experienced doctors are cruel to the younger doctors. And nurses are cruel to other nurses, the senior nurse to other nurses. It often happens to people who have jobs about caring for other people. So I want to make the point that this happens to everyone, can happen to anyone, regardless of your pay scale, regardless of your responsibilities. And I want people to understand that it's not them, it's not their fault, and nobody has ever asked to be bullied at work.
Thank you. I think that's so important because one of the things that we've talked about is the most demeaning and punishing aspects of bullying is the isolation.
It's the worst, in my view. And it happened to me several times, actually. I'll give you probably the worst example I have. It's a long story, but I'll try to truncate somewhat. I was with my fiance, Jennifer, who's now my wife of over 20 years. And we were on a plane for an approved, and I want to stress that, an approved vacation to Costa Rica. And I'm on the plane and I'm resting and I'm settling in. Both of us had a lot of pressure. My wife is an attorney and she represents domestic violence victims pro bono. So there's a lot of stress in her work. And my father-in-law had severe Parkinson's at the time. He's since passed away, but at the time he was in decline. And so it was our job and my wife's job to, or my fiance's job at the time, to take care of him. So we were just like settling into our seats for a vacation that we sorely needed. And I obviously was exhausted from working and being in television. I'm sitting in my seat and my phone rings and I figure it's a family member wishing us a good trip. It's my boss's assistant. My boss was the CEO of the network that I was working with at the time. And she says, "Are you off on vacation?" I say, "Yeah." She goes, "Well, Henry," the CEO's name, "Henry wants you back at work right now." And I'm like, "What?" She goes, "I can't quote him directly, but come back right now." She was editing a little bit because I don't think those were his exact words. And the doors of the plane were about to close. I mean, I'm frantic. I talked to a flight attendant. They're like, "I don't know. We're about to close the doors," and all this. We get off the plane. I go back to work. I had talked to a woman who was like a senior lieutenant for the CEO. She had approved my vacation and she had promised to take care of anything that happened at work. At the time, I was working on a pilot program. There was no hard deadline, but we were going to deliver a video to the CEO so he could look at it. She promised to take care of it. There were a couple of extra edits that needed to be made. And it was all taken care of. I had set it up the whole way. She neglected to tell the CEO that I had put all these things in place and that she had promised to take care of anything that came up. It was a simple few edits. It was nothing. And in fact, I tried to get it done, but there wasn't studio time before I left. I mean, that's really what happened. And so it was all taken care of. It was a nothing deal. And basically what happened is she neglected to tell the CEO that I put these things in place. And she made it look like I was being cavalier about getting it done. She sabotaged me. I don't know if it was a turf war and she wanted my turf, or she and the new CEO were part of a new regime. I was part of the old regime. There was a lot of stuff going on there. I was in shock. I just was crestfallen and almost catatonic in a way. I went home that night. I thought I was going to get fired. I came back. They took away my project. They canceled one of my shows. And to your point, Christina, I was completely ostracized. I had no meetings to go to because I had been vice president of original programming. And now I had no programming. And so no meetings. I just sat in my office. And we talked about shame. This was the height of my shame. I had been at this network for 8 years. I had been promoted. I created hit shows, making millions of dollars. And now I was a pariah. And what I did was I was so humiliated because people knew I was supposed to be on vacation. There I was. And they knew that I'd been essentially demoted. I was so humiliated and embarrassed. I couldn't even leave my office to go to the restroom down the hall. I just didn't want anyone to see me. And here I was a popular person. I was a senior executive. And so I took a Gatorade bottle out of my bag. And even now, thinking about it and telling this story, it hurts. And I took a Gatorade bottle, emptied it, had a little bit left. And I used that bottle kind of as my restroom, if you will. Instead of going down the hall, I just used it, closed it up so that I would not have to go down the hall and be seen by anyone. That's how humiliated I was. And it was just awful. And I stayed there for probably another month or 6 weeks, and then they let me go. I wasn't fired for cause. And the work, Henry, the CEO, never spoke another word to me, never asked me about what happened. And I didn't feel comfortable saying to him, well, you know, this other person said she'd take care of everything because he was loyal to her. He trusted her. She had power. And I couldn't win that war. If I had brought her integrity into question, I would have lost that war. I would have been fired even quicker for calling her integrity into question. So I had nowhere to go. I had no recourse other than to take it. And when I lost my job, I went home. And once again, I was ostracized. I was home alone. I mean, and that is the absolute worst feeling. And the fact that I was so proud of the work I had done there and it meant nothing. So that's my story in television, but it's happening to people in every workplace across the country doing every kind of work. And it's not fair. It's right. It's mean-spirited. And most importantly, I think other than the fact of how much it hurts, it's counterproductive to the best interests of a company to treat people that way. They didn't benefit from treating me that way. We know from the research that a chilling effect in communication, a lack of productivity, a lack of sharing ideas, all contribute. The result, I should say, of this kind of incivility and workplace aggression. And it's hard to understand why people would treat other people that way, especially good workers. So that's the kind of shame I've experienced. And I've talked to hundreds and heard thousands of stories. Everybody I talk to has a workplace bullying story.
Wow, Andy, that's a lot. So when you think of where you were on that day, you know, what has really helped you to heal? And I'm curious, how did you survive that? You know, was there anything during that helped to keep you going? And what helped you to heal now?
Yeah. Well, I'm still healing. And these stories didn't happen a week ago, a month ago, a year ago. Some of this stuff happened to me 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago. But it happened in almost every place I worked. And so I had to really think about it. The one thing I will say that I realized, I was resilient. I'll give myself credit for that. I was resilient. I kept going. I kept finding new jobs and I kept getting promoted and finding new opportunities. And I loved journalism and I loved working in television news. I loved being in the center of things and being kind of in the center of the world, following the most important things going on in the world. I loved that part of it. And so I kept pursuing that. I didn't give up. So there was resiliency, but I didn't even realize it was my only choice. I needed a paycheck. And I was so humiliated, I had to get out of that situation. So how did I start to heal? Well, again, I felt in writing my manuscript and now my book, that was a catharsis for me. I wanted to understand why and what and who, you know, and how did this happen to me? I'm such a good guy. I'm such a hard worker. I'm such a good person. And I'll mention, Christina, for a lot of us, you know, I was taught that if you're good to your teachers, if you're good to people, if you're kind, you work hard, it will come back to you. The kind of do unto others kind of notion. That's what I was taught as a young child. I think many of us were. And it's a bit of a naive notion in the workplace. There's no guarantee, no matter how good a person you are. And I was not a perfect employee. I'm not suggesting I was. Not at all. And I was a boss. From the time I was 32, I was an executive producer. I was not a perfect boss. I lost my temper at times. I was short with people. I interrupted people. But that's not the kind of incivility or workplace aggression we're talking about. We're also not talking about, nobody ever threw a stapler at my head. I'm not a Me Too victim. That's not this. This is about bullying and the fact that there's no laws in this country at all. In fact, most companies don't even have bylaws or codes of conduct that address this issue. And make it clear that it's unacceptable. that's what I'm advocating for. But getting back to your specific question about healing, I talked to, as I was writing my book, the first person I talked to was Dr. Gary Namy. And he's the founder of the Workplace Bullying Institute. And he's really the godfather of this movement, of this issue in the United States. And he was the one that made me realize that it wasn't my fault. I didn't ask for it, that I shouldn't blame myself. He started me on that road to understanding that I'm not alone, that there's many other people that have experienced it. And then I started talking to lots of other people, experts in the field. I must have interviewed for my book 25 or 30 people. And one of the things I found, which helped me a lot, was finding empathy. It's such a nice group of people, as you can imagine, because almost all the experts in this field are people that have been bully targets and bully victims themselves. And so just that feeling of, oh, I'm not a failure. I'm not a loser. I'm not a wimp. That I'm a good person and a good worker. And I've had a valuable career in many different ways, that I did have a positive effect on a lot of people. And often the bullying that I was experiencing, I shielded the rest of my team and my staff from it. And I tried to learn from the worst bullies, the worst bosses, and tried to conduct myself in the opposite way. So those are some of the ways that I started to heal, by learning from the other experts in the field and by taking all of their information in and combining it with my experience. And then really realizing, and this is something I'd like to talk about with you, is really understanding that the most important thing is not to give away your self-worth to an external force, an external person, the boss. I kept looking for the boss to be like a family member. My parents loved me because I was a great son and I cared for them and I was a good son and I did all the right things. I thought if I do that at work, the boss, my father or mother, will treat me with love back the way my own parents did. It's not a second family. That's the workplace is not a second family.
And they yes. And we've talked, because I experienced this too in my work as a pastor and in several different locations. And for me, Andy, it was the notion that if I met or exceeded the expectations that were set before me, all would be well.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that was not the case. There, something was always wrong. So for me, it was this sense of, you know, the moving, the bar was always moved. And so for me, I was left with a sense of I'm never good enough. Like I can never be good enough. And at the time, excuse me, my goodness. At the time, I had a sense that I needed to have my sense of affirmation and my sense of self come from my work.
Yeah.
Instead of intrinsically who I was. And that was a real problem for me. And since, thankfully, I've gotten out of those situations and done a bit of personal development and seen that has nothing to do with who I am. Who I am comes out of my identity. And what I do is a reflection, but it doesn't have bearing on my identity. That's something that nothing can change. But it's very difficult when we are in a position that we care so much about because we love and care for those with whom we work or for whom we work or are doing work that we're passionate about, to be treated very, very poorly, especially when we know intrinsically that we are doing good work.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fun story for me. You and I met through business, essentially, having no idea that we shared kinship of severe workplace aggression. And so we immediately got each other. And I think, like so many others, we allowed the people in charge, so to speak, to control us in a way. And it's hard to get away with that from that. I make the point, I created a television show with a Southern sheriff, and he was in Central Casting. He was from Central Casting. He looked the part, and he loved the part of a bully. I saw him with the inmates. I would never suggest that he bullied or abused the inmates in any way, but he played the role of the Southern sheriff to the hilt. And it occurs to me that other than a judge in a courtroom, and there's, you could probably think of a couple others, but a judge in a courtroom or a sheriff in a jail or a boss, you know, how many people have real control over your life? I mean, a boss controls your ability to pay your bills, your self-worth, your popularity in your own workplace where you're 10, 12, 14, 16 hours a day. Also controls your well-being when you go home at night, because most of us ruminate over, how did this happen? When's the bullying going to happen again? So it's all encompassing. And when you allow that person, and it's hard not to, but you have to work on not allowing that person to take over your entire being. And that's how I started to heal, by starting to say to myself, that's them, that's the work, I'm going to do the best I can. And I know it's more about them than it is about me, because I know I'm doing good work. But it's very difficult when the workplace is dangerous. I used to come to work every day not knowing when, and it didn't happen all the time. That was the thing. It's not like I was getting bullied every day, but the prospect or the specter of that email from the boss, oh, you know, where my heart would drop. And the assistant would say, Andy, the boss would like to have a word with you. And then that long walk, you know, where you're starting to sweat and your heart palpitations. And I did have anxiety, hypervigilance. I had digestive problems. And indeed, I had suicidal ideation, all because I felt like my life was out of my hands, that I was in danger in a way. And that's the first area I had to find a way to find psychological safety in my mind and body. That was the first step.
You talk about four steps that individuals can really master in order to find their joy and their sense of meaning and well-being again, that you actually teach people how to rediscover. Can we talk about those? Because I think they're so helpful. And really actually not just for those who are in workplace bullying, but for people in any sort of recovering from any sort of trauma, but specifically applicable to those who have encountered workplace bullying or who are experiencing that, to really look at, you know, what can life be again? Let's talk about those.
Oh, I'd love to. So I'll go through them and feel free to interject and go through this. Because I'm still doing it today, and I'm not in a bullying situation today, but I'm still working on these things because it's so part of me. So as I mentioned just previously, I'll go through them and then I'll talk a little bit about each one. So you need to establish that you're safe in your mind and body. Slow down, that you're in the situation currently, but you know, it is not a war zone, although it may feel like one. And so you just have to sit and put some perspective into it. Hopefully, and not in every case, but you have loving family and friends, and we'll talk about that too. But you just have to sit back and say, this is not everything. It's important, and you want to do the best job you can, but you need to feel safe and allow yourself to feel safe in your thinking and in your body. And that can also be exercise, meditation, things like that. But that's where I start with people that I talk to. And then as part of that, you want to restore your self-worth. You need to, again, recognize that this person who's doing the bullying is likely doing this to other people. And while they may have targeted you, and that's a very, very difficult set of circumstances, and I know it all too well, you can still have self-worth and not let the bully boss completely take that away from you. And something that I'm going to talk a little bit more, because this is the most important thing. When I was going through this, I couldn't, and I'll get more into it, I couldn't enjoy life. I couldn't enjoy any aspects of life. And that's a shame. And that a bit was on me, but I just didn't know how to get out of it. I just hated life. And that's where the suicidal ideation came up. Because I felt so ashamed and so bad about myself, that it just got worse and worse. And I had a lot of negative self-talk. And along those lines, it's not just about finding joy, but it's about finding, reigniting your purpose in both what you're doing in your work and your life. And when you're being bullied and you're taking it all and you lose all of those things, I'll give you an example. Like, I felt like I was in danger and I couldn't cope. I didn't know what to do. In fact, at the height of some of the aggression, the worst aggression that I experienced, I had this dream, recurring dream of my boss. It was his head, his face, half animal, half human, half beast, half animal. I'm sorry, half beast, half human. And we were at a boiling cauldron, literally, and he was attacking me. And I couldn't get out. When that's happening, you can look for professional help, but you have to take a step back and do self-care, gratitude, meditation, and allow yourself to say, I know that's what I'm thinking. I know that's on my mind, but that's not reality. That's not really what's happening here. I allowed my whole identity to get wrapped up in validation from the bully. And when I, in my self-healing, I look at my core instead of my ego, right? My ego was wrapped up in external validation. Oh, am I a good person today? Did I get good ratings for my show? Did anybody say it was good? It was all ego. It was all about getting that love from the boss. No, you want to pursue love and caring and friendship from people that will love and care for you back. And as I mentioned earlier, I lost my ability to feel joy. I had no sense of gratitude in life. And there's so much to be grateful for in the world, even when you're being bullied. I couldn't enjoy a fall hike. I couldn't enjoy my favorite foods. Nothing tasted good. I couldn't even enjoy the companionship of others. I mean, I didn't go out. I stayed home. If I tried to go out, I'd leave early. Now, I'm much more present in the moment, and that's what you want to be. That's where you want to be. And I do find value in the work I'm doing. And I can find joy in hiking. I work with homeless people here in New York City and getting a hug from a homeless person. And that'll get you back to a perspective of what's important. And I do love being with people. For a long time, I was my own worst bully, in fact, that I was saying worse things to myself sometimes than the bully was saying to me. And now I have self-acceptance, I have a spark, and I have meaning in my life. So those are the things that I'm working on, that I've thought about, that I've talked to experts about. It's even, in a way, changing your brain makeup, which can happen. You know, there's this term neuroplasticity. You can change the structure of your brain to reorganize and allow yourself to think in a different way. It can happen. It takes work. I'm still working on it. But these are the kinds of things that I'm talking to people about, that I'm writing about, that I'm researching, that I'm talking to experts about, and that I want to share with people who are either going through it or have gone through it and are feeling so negative about their experience. I'm changing my life. I've got a ways to go, but I know I can help other people do the same.
Andy, what I love most about this is that all of these things are tangible and you can start with very small steps. That there's immediate relief with just small, tangible steps. That it's about moments rather than huge shifts that take really big decisions. that it's all about moment by moment by moment. And I think that when we're in situations where we're reliving the past, it's important to give ourselves that grace, because we know that for the brain to remember, memory is it's about reimagining. They've done studies. It's reimagining. And when you are reimagining the trauma, your brain doesn't know that it's the past. And that's why it feels so real, because you are actually reliving it. And so it's so important to be kind to yourself and give yourself the moment of joy, or the moment of peace, or the moment of still, the moment of calmness, to train your brain to remember what that even feels like again. Because it's too much to say, oh, well, I'm going to take back my life. Well, what does that even mean? And sometimes we put so much pressure on ourselves to just like be different or get ourselves under control. So this is so kind to simply go about change moment by moment, because that is doable.
Yeah. And as a pastor, you know that better than anyone, as you serve your community. I mean, in television, I worked on a television show that was kind of a Dr. Phil kind of show, if you know that, where a psychiatrist or counselor is helping others. And the whole show was supposed to be on television about empathy. And it was the meanest, most mean-spirited, toxic work environment I've ever been in. And so these kinds of experiences, which I've learned, and this is trauma. Yeah. It is trauma. And many people consider it a form of PTSD. And I'm like, well, wait a minute. You know, I didn't even serve in the Army. I'm not going to compare myself to people who serve for this country, especially in wartime, in battle. No. But we can allow ourselves to say, this is a form of trauma.
It is.
And it does get lodged in your long-term memory. And I think you know this, Christina, and so many people. I remember so well exactly where I was, what I was wearing, the room where I was bullied, what the person said exactly, what their intonation was. It gets stored and it's right there. And so, yes, in small bits. And in fact, just talking to Gary and Amy for that first time, the head of the Workplace Bullying Institute, in a 5-minute conversation, it started to change my way of thinking. It started to change my life, and my shoulders that had been like this about all this started to drop a little bit. And I was able to relax and say, okay, there's help. And I've dedicated the last 5 years of my life to learning about this issue, understanding it, talking to people, sharing my experience, which even to this day in this conversation, I'm not proud of any of this. These are not accomplishments. I'm about accomplishments and achievement. This is not something I can't wait to tell people about, because it doesn't show me in a very good light in any way. But I feel that I have a voice and I have a perspective and I have empathy, and now I have knowledge, and I just want to share that with others.
Absolutely. And Andy, you have an incredible, generous gift for people as your free gift. Would you like to tell people what that is?
Yeah, sure. I mean, my whole impetus for this is to talk to bully targets and bully victims. I'm interested in talking to anyone who cares about this issue, but my focus is on trying to help others who've been through what I've been through. And all I have to do is click on the link, and I'll give them a free counseling session. I'm not selling anything. I'm not trying to sell you anything. I'm not here to do that. I'm here to help, and it's a free consultation. As I said, I work very closely with a homeless organization here in New York City, and I get great joy from just getting a hug and talking to homeless people. It's a terrible problem here and across the country, and I would like to, in a similar fashion, give, even if it's a digital hug, to other people who are looking for some guidance, for some counseling. And I want to be clear, I'm not a psychologist. I'm not a psychiatrist. I can't cure anybody of anything. What I can do is share my experience, share my knowledge, share my understanding, and as I said, my empathy, in the hope that I can begin to send people on the course and the progress that I've experienced over the last 5 years trying to deal with this issue in myself.
That is very generous, Andy. Thank you so much for that. Andy's amazing. So everybody just really go to that link and take Andy up on that conversation. And Andy, any final words of wisdom that you'd like to leave people with?
Well, I'll tell you, again, in my research, it's really an interesting inflection point in my view at this time. No matter how you feel about politics, and this will air after the election is over. We're recording it just before the election. And it doesn't matter which side you're on. Civility and public discourse is going to be a topic of conversation for years to come, about how we talk to each other, how we communicate. And no matter which side of the aisle you're on, this is going to matter. Just like Me Too matter. And so the time is now to talk about this issue, to deal with it, both on a personal level and an advocacy level.
Andy, it's been so great to have you with us today. Hosting you on your own show has been so fun. Thank you for such a great conversation.
Thank you.
Yeah. And one last final word of wisdom.
Yeah. Don't be alone. You're not alone. There is help. There are resources. We're here, and we're here to help you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Christina.